Accession number 29954, reel 10.
We are emailing each other, and the other two were Warner and Rhodes. And at Fairford, we were in at Anderson Manor. One funny thing happened. I was joined to Theo Neumann, and Theo Neumann had two very unpleasant habits. One was he had sweaty feet, as a result of which he every night, or even more than once a day sometimes, washed his socks out and laid them out on the windowsill, which was nearer to my bed than his. And the second was that he was a chain smoker. He was also beginning to suffer from mania. What's that called?
Depression.
I didn't know that. He knew it already. And he was, during that time, he was sent on a lonely scheme to test his own ability. Warner and Rhodes were, as I see from their life story, he was let loose somewhere in Birmingham or somewhere, and the whole of the forces there were supposed to find him. He had to survive for 3 or 4 weeks being a wanted man. But he had a breakdown during the time, halfway through it. And he came back, never told me. He gave me some idea, but I never found out, really. You don't ask when you hear that he had a breakdown.
Something like that, would you have thought that he might, if your commanders would have found out that, would that have been enough to take...
I would have thought so, but I suppose... He knew exactly at what stage his depressive mania was. He was able to tell them exactly at what point he might not be reliable. I can imagine that. Also, he was of political importance to them. That will come a little later, but he was the only one in the whole of that lot who was politically concerned to return to Austria, and had the possibility of making contacts with social democrats. And Austria had a lot of social democrats, many of whom might have voted for Hitler when he had come, but they had been illegal social democrats for many years, and they didn't really change their political views right away.
Did you know anything about his political views?
Nothing. I was politically as naive as I had been before I lost my virginity. The second thing was his chain smoking, and he would light the next cigarette from the one he was smoking. And there was one occasion when he was apparently working out a plan, and he was a very clever man, very nervous, a very high voice, not a very attractive man, thin strands of reddish hair, some growing out of his ears, terrible varicose veins on his legs. But he was such a nice man that I gradually got used and liked him, to him and liked him. But physically he was difficult to like, especially once we were in the army when he didn't look after himself so well. Anyway, he was going through the room smoking cigarette after cigarette. Now, I had put up in that room at every top surface a little tin which served as an ashtray. The room didn't have a lot of surfaces, but there was the window ledge, there were the bedside tables, there was a table, and I watched him anxiously as the tobacco stub, you know, the grew longer and longer, and he was going around thinking and thinking, and when he did this you couldn't disturb him. He lost his thread and he had to start all over again. And I watched him pass one ashtray after another and go round and round and round, smoking and lighting another one. That became, the stub became so long. And suddenly he stopped, looked at his cigarette, was about there in the room, walked all the way to the window, and there was a bullet hole in there. I pushed his cigarette through the bullet hole and stubbed out his cigarette. I thought this is a funny incident which belongs to the history. When we came to Fairford, we were all in our groups.
How did that take place? Were you selected by Theo Neumann? Or did you
I know that I was selected by Theo Neumann. How this came about, I don't know. But I was actually told, although theoretically I could have refused, they would not force anyone. For instance, nobody wanted Peter Priestley, poor old Peter Priestley. And Faltacek was too old and not fit enough. He'd broken his spine when we jumped, for anyone to become anyone's partner for jumping. So, and there were a couple of German groups formed. And at Fairford, we were having some of them, you could see. They would sit in the garden or in the outside together, poring over maps. And I remember seeing Georgie Bryant and his three people. They were being prepared for going abroad up to a certain point, learning to know the area, etc. Whilst we were there, Alan Grant and Kaminsky, a couple of others, disappeared. Well, people suddenly disappeared. I had a terrible row with the officer in charge, who claimed that I must have told my girlfriend in Scotland that Grant was going into action. But Grant sister was his girlfriend, and I'm pretty sure that he told her. Anyway, I knew I hadn't told her, but he showed me a letter. Look, there she's writing to you, saying, I hope Alan Grant is going away. Oh, we shouted at each other until Theo Neumann came in and soothed. Theo Neumann had changed his name to Norman, but I never got used to this new name, so I still always refer to him as Theo Neumann. And gradually people disappeared. We had a bit of training there, but not much. We were waiting to go. And we had one big exercise, a three-day exercise, in which the whole of this place, I forget its name, was considered a German Gau. You know, Gau was a district with a Gauleiter, a Nazi in charge. And we were all given, on bits of papers, roles to play. So some of us were Nazis, some of us were the British agents. And I was Theo's wireless operator, as in reality. And Theo was in charge of the... Perhaps that was the alternative to his having failed. And nobody knew what the other one was. Except for me and Theo, we knew that we were together. And we had to go around recruiting people without their, if they were Nazis, finding out that... Well, we divided the job, and Theo gave me the job of dealing with the staff, that is, the non-operational staff on the premises, because everybody was included somehow or other. And I knew I had one friend there, and I sort of gradually found out that he was supposed to be on whoever side recruited him, which was perhaps all the staff were. Anyway, he was, and I arranged with him on the night of the attack, that is the third night, he should take all the bolts out of all the rifles, which he did. And apparently the whole of the action was it wasn't a real action, but Theo was successful. Nobody was discovered, and he got all the people, almost everybody who was supposed to be on our side, he had found them. And so from that point of view, it was a great success. There is another very interesting scheme we had on Portland. I'd come back to it if you don't mind, because it was really fantastic, from Anderson Manor. But come back to Fairford now. there was a big row about the bolts. Well, we didn't know that this was within days of the actual invasion of France. And we didn't know that there was a general alert to all the commanding officers in the country. Be special alert, the Germans might do a counter-offensive. And of course, so what we did was actually really dangerous, because if Germans had come, they would... But of course, I wasn't... Well, how was I to know that? Shall I come back to that other thing at Anderson Manor? Yeah. Really, the highlight of our training at Anderson Manor was another three-day scheme. You know the Isle of Portland? You know, have you been there? Well, the Isle of Portland isn't really an isle. There's a causeway connecting it with Weymouth. And we were divided into five teams, and we had to put the defences of the port of the Isle of Portland, which was an important military harbour, out of action. And we were given five objectives. One was the naval headquarters, which was on a boat along the pier. One was the fortification top of a hill. The whole of Portland is a big hill in the centre with the Verne in the middle, which was a fortress. Then there was a military HQ down on along the main road. Around there's a main road going around. There's a little bit of flat area with villages at the bottom of the of this big hill. Another one was the transformer, the main transformer station, and the fifth one was a defensive machine gun nest at the halfway or almost at the top of the hill, looking out towards the sea from where an enemy. And the concept would approach, and the concept was that we were dropped there 3 days beforehand, and it was up to us to put the defences of the island out of action. And the whole of the forces of the island, that is the navy, the army, the what do you call the civilian people, the
home guard,
everybody was to look out. We had a code word, which was wolf. So that we didn't really start shooting at each other. We were given pistols without bullets, of course, and it was the old-fashioned, which now sounds funny, bang, bang, you're dead. But that had to... And there were, of course, umpires all over the place, and we had so-called hand grenades, which were about half a sausage of plastic explosive with a detonator in it. Now, a detonator exploding would not be strong enough to explode the explosive. You need a primer in between. But it would make a bang. And so each of us had about three or four of us. But, again, I was picked to be the radio operator of the chap in charge, who was Yogi Meyer. He was in charge of the whole scheme. At that time, we weren't yet allocated to partners. And we were, a few days before the scheme started, we were all given a bit of money to go into Weymouth and try and find out about Portland what we could. I tried very hard to make up to a Wren who came from Portland, but the Wrens were so snobby they wouldn't have anything with a soldier. So I didn't find out very much, except for I went as near as I could to the causeway, and I found that in the middle there was a big main road, but on the side between the main road and the sea was quite a long, flat area. And so... I was probably not the only one who found that out. But anyway, on the night in which we were supposed to have been dropped, we made our individual ways, not in proper uniform, but in the fatigue dresses, and walked along the sea, and it was dark. Actually, the moon was very strong, but exactly for that reason, you couldn't be seen very easily, unless you were in a silhouette, and you obviously used bushes and so on. I don't know how the others got. Anyway, Yogi Meyer and I were the first ones on, and there were a lot of bombed houses, And not far from the beginning of the island were quite a few of those, and we chose one of those and went upstairs and took up our HQ there, and I sent out my radio messages giving them the position, and then all the others who followed had to report to us before they went on to their positions. One of those coming on and who was rather careless about it was Walter Freud. Instead of walking in the shadow, and so he walked on the main road thinking that was very clever. In a way, he wasn't noticed, because after all, he was in a kind of uniform. But what he didn't know is that somebody followed him. Cut long story short, soon after he had left us, after having reported to us, a home guard came upstairs to our unit. So Yogi Maya, we heard him, and Yogi Maya positioned himself top of the stairs and then said, "Bang, bang, you're dead." And we said, "Operation Wolf," and he said, "I don't know anything about that." So he went down, Yogi Maya, he went down to call an umpire, get an umpire, and the umpire decided, yes, the home guard was dead, but the shots would have caused some suspicion, and we were given, I think, 5 minutes, maybe it was 10 minutes, to get out. So I loaded my radio on my shoulders. It was a sort of rucksack type of thing, and we rushed out, and just behind was the beginning of the hill, and it was black night, and Yogi Maya, and that's something I've never forgiven him, said to me, "We just sit down there and you quickly send the emergency signal so that somebody else takes over, because we can't escape." And I took no notice. I was disobedient. I should have been shot for it. I ran towards the edge of fences, private houses, jumped over one, and after some hesitation he followed me. And over in that garden I found a tomato greenhouse and made my way into the tomato greenhouse, bent down. For the next few hours, we weren't discovered. Not only were we not discovered, for a couple of hours there was a bit of a muddle on the air, because the Frank Kelly, who had taken over the radio on my instead of me, was beginning to send out signals, and I was sending out signals, but eventually it all got adjusted, and Yogi Maya was in charge again. And then the funniest thing that ever happened to me in my life, we were allowed one friendly inhabitant on the island, and that was him. He happened to be a relative of Jimmy Bennett's. So late in the evening, you know, we went down to their room and had something to eat. But during the day, literally, we lived off the tomatoes as they were ripe. I crawled around. There was always one tomato that had got ripe. That was a very exciting period. For 2 days, the other groups got themselves ready for the last night's attack.
And they were all scattered around.
They were in different places, yes. I don't even know exactly where they were. But in places from where they could make their attack. In fact, the people who were supposed to attack the naval HQ on the ship were doing it by swimming in through the water. They were actually discovered. There wasn't much of a chance of getting onto that boat without being seen, because there was a long pier. The pier was gone. They were one of our failed objective. But by midnight, Jimmy Bennett came around to us and said, "Well, you can really go back. Your role is over. No more signals. The theory is that at early dawn our ships arrive, and either the defenses are out or they're not." And Yogi Maya, however, had one more task, apparently. I didn't know. So I said to Jimmy, "Look, Jimmy, couldn't I just walk around a bit with my..." And I thought to myself, I have to do something very special. I made my way up in a very sharp moonlight on that night, even more than on the first night. So the bushes threw huge shadows, and I made my way up to the Wern, the fortress. The Wern had a moat, but it was an empty moat, and there was a bit of a pathway, you might say. It wasn't a pathway, but it was a bit of a path against the wall which you could walk, and I walked along. I kept on thinking, if I could get into the Wern, that would be really something. But the stones from which the Wern is made are about that high. Exactly that high.
So about 6 foot?
Yeah. Okay. And about three of them. And going backwards. So I walked around the whole of the Wern. I came near the main gate, threw stones to try and make the guard go away, but of course that was an old trick nobody ever had. So I gave it up, and I must tell you right now, Walter Freud climbed it. I'll never find out how he did it, but he climbed it. But he was always that kind of daredevil. He made his way into the Wern, then was caught, tried to say, I've killed you all, by throwing one of his bombs in the big hall, but they wouldn't have it. They said, all right, one of us is wounded. And they put him into a cell, and there he fell for the oldest trick in the world. They put another prisoner next to him, and he told him all about it. That's just a side story. I then made my way up a path, and suddenly I heard someone come up this path. So I stepped into the bushes. Now, the people on the island who'd been warned were told commandos and really tough guys and so on. And of course, we had our faces blackened. And so as whoever came up that path came close to me, I stepped out, put my pistol out, said, put your hands up. He was a little man. He had no arms at all. He was full equipment. He was a little man. And so I made him my prisoner. Do you know, that man was really scared. I had a feeling I was in a real enemy. It was the nearest I've ever come to being in enemy country. So I thought, well, what can I do now with him? You know, what can I do with a prisoner? If this were reality, I would know what to do. So I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll walk him onto the main road ahead of me. Nobody will know who I am if I walk behind him. And then when I'm near enough to the causeway, I'll let him go and run. However, as we came halfway, as we walked along on the main road, he in front of me, shaking, this poor little fat little man was shaking all the time. He thought I would really shoot. Suddenly noise, shouting next to me, and it turned out that Yogi Maya was there with one of the groups he had joined. They had actually caught the HQ, and the little man had been sent before the HQ had surrendered, a little hut, up to the Wern command to tell them that they should take over the command. So I had theoretically done quite a very good thing, except for when I heard all this noise, I took one of my hand grenades and threw it, and Yogi Maya came down and says, now we are dead. And they had been arguing whether so this makes the whole thing a bit ridiculous, doesn't it? Anyway, but the amazing thing was that we had achieved 3.5 of the objectives. During my walking around, I also came across Billy Hertzberg, Billy somebody or the other, group who were attacking the machine gun nest. They did not achieve. They were killed. You would say they were. They did not achieve. They did not take the machine gun. But that was the only, that and the naval station were the only two objectives that were not completely achieved. And one that was half achieved, can't remember exactly how this was. I think it was the mass of the electricity, the transformer station. The officer in charge there in the morning, when it came to there was a showdown between the officers, he said, Well, no, our masts have not been taken. So he was taken to the masts, and there were the explosives laid. They hadn't even noticed it. Our chaps had crawled to the masts, had fastened the explosives, and got away without the guards seeing them. And that was a... anyway, that's the story of Portland, and I thought this was a story that was worth telling.